This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the head priest and training coordinator at Zen Mountain Monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
There are so many unsung heroines and heroes at this broken moment in our collective story. So many courageous persons who, unbeknownst to themselves, are holding together the world by their resolute love or contagious joy. Although I do not know your names, I can feel you out there. So, that's a quote by David Abram, which was on somebody's email, and I loved it. Although I do not know your names, I can feel you out there. And some names we do know. I thought, you know, I was thinking about tomorrow. It's Martin Luther King Day, and I recognized that, and I was doing some readings, and I recognize that it's just over a half a century that has passed since those momentous events of the civil rights movement that took place in the 1960s. And while we may not see that level of violence or societal racism that was evident then, obviously we know it continues. And this is kind of hard, you know, to talk about in some ways, but I have a personal vow, and many in our Sangha do, to see how I experience my mind and prejudice against us, against others, where I don't feel even worthy myself, and so how can I express that and see that in others, the dignity. And how, despite all the good intentions I can and have and may think I'm doing the right thing, could still be perpetuating something. So you don't see what you don't see. It has to be brought out. And what use is, I don't want to say sort of use, but what's the point of Zen practice in all this if we don't look into our conditioned mind? That's what it's about. It's all the conditioned mind. How could a path of spiritual liberation possibly unfold if we turn away from the realities that this particular embodiment brings? And in my deepest wisdom, I know we each need the particular body that we have, that has been given with its unique form, color, shape, sex, for liberation to unfold. It's exactly perfect. The one you have, the one I have, is exactly perfect. We have to have it and not ignore ours or others, because so much hatred against each other is generated through the mind because of this superficial appearance of the body. Whole groups of people, I respectfully remind us, have been genocided, massacred on preconceived, unacceptable differences. And when we chant this line that's been added, may true justice and freedom permeate the Dharma world, this thing is like so, tears me up like every time. It's really something. May true justice and freedom permeate the Dharma world. Oh my God, can you imagine? And it happens person to person, body to body, eyeball to eyeball, and seeing our conditioning. And then we have the Buddhist practice to see right into the bottom of it, the ground of our being. And I was reading this, I'll get to it, this letter from that King, Dr. King wrote from the Birmingham jail, which is exactly the diamond net of Indra, which I'll get to in a moment. He's saying the same thing about this mutuality, this mutual interdependent world that we live in. But I went to the Vimalakirti Sutra. I hope you can follow me on this, on how a bodhisattva, and for those of you who are new, welcome. A bodhisattva is you. I'm assuming it's all of us, one who cares for others and wants to realize their true nature, your true nature, for the benefit of saving all beings. That it kind of works mutually as we're working on ourselves. We can't wait, you know, till it's complete, but we work on it together. And in this chapter, on the seventh chapter, I read it once before on the goddess. I'm not going to do that part, but it begins with Manjushri Bodhisattva, who's the Bodhisattva of wisdom, you know, with the sword that cuts off all your entanglements and all your clinging, your false notions. You know, there's Manjushris in our life, right? We know people who do that for us, like just whack with their sword, you know, cut off that. Nah, sorry. And he offers a profound teaching with the Buddha about the nature of compassion and the skillfulness we gain from the experience of selflessness, which is one of the primary tastes, if you will, flavors of Buddhism, is this selflessness. In the early teachings of Buddhism, that there is no solid self, and no fixed entity in anything, no self-nature. That's an early Buddhist notion. So it's Manjushri's asking, "Good sir, how should a bodhisattva regard all living beings?" And actually, it's not with the Buddha, it's with Vimalakirti, who's a lay practitioner, a lay wise man, who's said to have the realization equivalent to the Buddha. But Vimalakirti lives in the world and uses the world rather than the monastic community as his teaching place. So libraries, board meetings, brothels, anywhere that he can teach. And so that's who Manjushri is speaking to. "Good sir, how should a bodhisattva regard all living beings?" Vimalakirti replied, "Manjushri, a bodhisattva should regard all living beings as a wise person regards the reflection of the moon in water, as magicians regard people created by magic, like a mass of clouds in the sky, like the previous moment of a ball of foam," and all these, like this whole big paragraph of the descent of a non-returner into a womb, like the existence of desire, hatred, and folly in a saint, like the perception of color in one blind from birth, like the track of a bird in the sky, like the pregnancy of a barren woman, like fire burning without fuel. That's how we should regard living beings. And what do we find in all those situations? "Precisely thus, Manjushri, does a bodhisattva who realizes ultimate selflessness consider all beings." And then he says, if a bodhisattva considers all living beings in such a way, how does he generate great love toward them? And he says, Vimalakirti says, he just thinks, "Just as I've realized the Dharma, so should I teach it to living beings. Thereby he generates the love that is truly a refuge for all living beings. The love that is peaceful because it's free of grasping. The love is not feverish because it's free of passions, the love that accords with a reality because it's equanimous, the love that is without conflict because it's free from the violence of passions, love that is firm, its high resolve is unbreakable like a diamond, and all these ways, whole paragraph again, the love that is morality because it improves immoral living beings, the love that is tolerance because it protects both self and others, the love that looks upon beings with dignity. This, Manjushri, is the great love of a bodhisattva. So when we look closely, we see that the mind, of course, our mind, my mind, can be filled with judgments. And the way we push away otherness, whether it be religion or a different ethnic, a class, a sexual preference, age. I just went to a play where aging actresses were pushed aside. Like they didn't have their use anymore, and the whole play was about that, their that attitude of aging. Opinions, aversions, all the things that we make self from, all the twisted karma born of our body, mouth, and thought. In the Dhammapada, Buddha says, mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind-wrought. Now, Buddha is addressing monastics, but we can easily read his words in reference to a collective mind of a group. Mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind-wrought. It could be a society, a nation, a culture, a world. When we ourselves fall into this mind state of excluding and even hating because of someone's appearance, we render them or the group invisible, unnamed, unsung. And what kind of act or forced power or privilege is in motion when someone elevates their self and puts down others, especially because of their embodiment? It's hard to fathom. And the problem is that we begin to believe the ideas that are presented to us. We believe them and we fixate on them. We marry them. And then we can't be free at all. And it is through the body. We cannot close our eyes to any denigration of any body. And if we want to be awake and aware and liberated, it won't work. We can't bypass and look for transcendence. So that's the bypass, you know, where we just want to go to some lofty state or it's all empty. It's true, but it's also there's things to deal with in this human realm to get to that, to keep that as the basis, and yet see the karma, see the carnage, and the good things. We have to engage each other with what we are, the physical and the formless, the relative and the absolute. So it was over 50 years ago that Dr. Martin Luther King was jailed in Birmingham, Alabama, for his role in organizing a non-violent protest against segregation in that city. And while he was in jail, he began to write a letter because the jailers wouldn't even allow him paper. So he wrote the letter on the margins of newspaper and he would give the newspaper to his lawyers and they would just carry it out to the outside world. And it's one of, I think, and has been said to be one of his most powerful, inspired writings. Could have been because of where he was. And in responding to questions as to why he was in Birmingham and why he was creating trouble, he writes, Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all. See the diamond net? The diamond net is an image from Buddhism, where in a vast web, there's a diamond at every intersection of the net that reflects every other part of what's there. So you can't pick up, in koans you say, you pick up one corner, you see all four. So we're all connected, as he's saying it right there. You can't separate any of this out, this inescapable mutuality. And it's a truth that's bigger than Buddhism or any particular religious path or political view. It's just the way it is. It's the law. What affects one directly, he says, affects all indirectly. So at that time, when he was in jail, I was entering the first grade. I was 5 years old. I don't know if some of you may not have even been here yet, 1960. But I was in first grade, 5 years old. And of course, I was too young to understand the significance of what he was saying or what was emerging in a civil rights movement, what that was about. But what I did see were the images that were on the nightly TV that blared in our house, that blared at our dinner table. And I could feel it, and I could hear it. And I saw it in my little eyeballs. Some of the ugliest scenes, besides the Vietnam War, some of the ugliest scenes of people hating one another. I took this in, as many of us did. Different people, different skins fighting. Police officers with clubs. Smoky screens, like just tear gas, and like there's people in there. And I remember feeling it and keeping very quiet about it. I did ask. But I remember feeling kind of battered. And I remember I asked, but I actually got no response from my parents. It was silent. There were no intentional conversations. So I live today with these images stored someplace, and my little system has grown into this system, tinged with more subtle, more implicit bits of conversation I would overhear, as many of us did, remarks made, the way they saw the double messages of appearances and behind the scenes. And I didn't really look at it until very recently. You know, we don't know what we don't know, and then when it starts coming out, and as you practice, you know, you either look or you turn away. Receiving, seeping into our earthen bodies, beliefs, value sets about what's important, how society should be, about the way the world is, stories about money, class, gender, about race, and stories that are never questioned, never asked a question. Went through all the history, never presented in history. Not that history. That's not the one I got. And studies have shown, I found, that children as young as 3 are already picking up racial attitudes long before they have any understanding of them. And it's difficult to see the conditioning in these stories because it's so hardwired. We all have inherited this to not bring it conscious. We will, if we don't bring it conscious, which is being a practitioner and being with one another in Sangha and having each other come together, every time we bring one of these stories up to daylight and take a look at it, it's a little bit more liberation. This one teacher, Alan Sanaki, who works in this in such a way, full out, talking about racism and how we will practice with it. He says, we try to uncover our own thought patterns. This is painful and embarrassing, but is the essence of saving myself and saving all sentient beings. It is amazing to see the stories that we can make up about other people and how these stories are conditioned by race and class and privilege. This is why we need a mindfulness practice where we watch our thoughts about any kind of difference, about any kind of picking and choosing. So even if you feel like none of this applies to you, which I have before, it's important to recognize that there's still conditioning in our mind. We can't live in this society without not having absorbed this. So I told you over the summer I read The Way of Tenderness by Zenju Earthlyn Manuel. She's a woman priest in the lineage of Suzuki Roshi. She's gay and she's black. And she really rose. She went into Zen training and sat in the Zendo day after day, looking at her mind, being in a very uncomfortable place, but that was like her, like she felt the truth of the Dharma underneath. And I really resonated with her core message. And for her, it did come through years of wrestling the pain of racism and discrimination. And this is so powerful. I want to say, like, the things that we want to get rid of or that we're so tangled in, that is the in. If you can turn towards it so fully with this open mind and heart to yourself, and it's so uncomfortable, it's excruciating, drawing back projections, and it is a can opener for sure. Because if it's so bound in us, then that it's like when resistance is so strong in us, there's a gem in there that is our awakening. It really is. So she writes, this is her message, that going beyond into another existence was not the spiritual awakening. She says, we must come through the fire of our lives to experience awakening. We are all tender and sore from the hatred, no matter where we fall in the continua within race, sexuality, and gender. We are tender in a raw sense, and not necessarily in a soft and gentle way. The tenderness is of a wounded nature. Our tenderness is our aching sensitivity and vulnerability. Can we be tender in the raw sense and still actively walk the path of liberation? The body coming through the fire and not around it, she says, was awakening for me. So, you know, we think of enlightenment as this, maybe you do, many have this big bang of lights and bliss and flotation through the world. No, it's a destructive process. It has nothing to do with becoming bigger or happier or better. In light, everything true crumbles away. That isn't true. Everything that isn't true crumbles away. It has to. It has to. But we just like, no, no. That is not true. Oh, yes, it is, says reality. Sorry. Whew. Gone. Wah! If someone is asking, how should a bodhisattva regard living beings? we should also know we disregard living beings. And when I read this part of Zenju, it reminded me of a poem I recently read by Emily Dickinson. This coming out of the trance, like trying to transcend, like what's right before us, like not through it, like actually we have to go through the crucible of our feelings and our conditioning to actually see the light. This poem she wrote, she writes, it's hard, Emily, you got to kind of, you know, I don't know, she's, you got to kind of sit with her for a while. There is a pain so utter, it swallows substance up, then covers the abyss with trance, so memory can step around across upon it, as one within a swoon goes safely where an open eye would drop him bone by bone. Okay, so I'll just give you my takeaway. Of course, pain is a reoccurring theme in her poetry. You wonder about her being in her room all the time. But there she was, writing on lots of envelopes. And the poem, I don't know, possibly describes an altered state of mind, like a trance or a swoon, which makes pain bearable. In this state of mind, the memory is allowed to be selective, to kind of step around the abyss. So in practice, we're not stepping around, but right into and through the trance. That's waking up. It's like snapping out of the trance, wanting to snap out, looking for how to. I need not be afraid of going into the dark to reclaim all the fierce love and care for life before I forget. Before I began to forget. As the Buddha says, question everything with the Dharma eye of viewing all things. Only when I have the willingness to look at all of it, to not pretend it's not there, can I experience more freedom from it. It's so true. Only when I have the willingness, so you have to do it willingly. Willingly, that's a big word, to actually offer yourself, willingly go there, to look at it, to not pretend it's not there. That's when we can experience more freedom from the situation. Otherwise, if we don't examine whether we're aware of it or not, it festers. And it festers in ways we may not associate. And we may even start to believe it. And the great thing about our practice is everything that arises is grist for the mill. No matter what our thoughts say about the other or ourself, it's conditioning. And that's what we need to see. See what can manifest in a conditioned mind. And say, ah, there you are. Hello. Out of the shadows. And breathe in and breathe out. All that we encounter in our own minds, important that we remember one of the profound teachings of the Buddha, where he said, to take nothing whatsoever as me or mine. This is not me. I am not this. This is not mine. Whatever arises in our mind, this is not me, the solidity. I am not this. This is not mine. All of it. So it's not like you don't own what you're conditioning, but it's not it's not like a fixed thing, right? It's all a flow of conditioned things arising and passing away. We learned it. All the negative thoughts, all the loving thoughts, from a practice standpoint, they're all just thoughts. They arise under certain conditions and pass away. And then when we believe it and it gets momentum, we see. We see what the world turns to. So I read this article in the op-ed section of the New York Times, which really stopped me and hit me. And it was written by a black man, a professional, who wondered why on trains white people didn't sit next to him. And I just was like, do I do this? Like, is this in my view? Like, can I, like, and it was hard, you know, it's like, do I do that? Do I do this with anyone? And just not to, you know, be mad at myself, but I want to learn. I don't know what's unconscious. I want to test it. Where do I place myself? That's coming out of the trance, not around it. To what are the choices we make and what don't we know? What aren't we aware we're making? Sometimes people tell me, do you know you just, or if I feel someone pull me somewhere else, it's like, what was that? How come you went over there and there's a few seats here? What was, oh, wow. Huh. So we do that for each other. Oh, you know, now come on, can you tell? Can you really like say it? Like what's happening? Thich Nhat Hanh talking about how we can work with suffering that arises up from the past. He says, this could be our own personal pain or it could be at the societal level. He says, if we are standing firmly in the present, we can see the ghosts of the past which follow us into the present, also belong to the present moment. To observe these ghosts deeply is to transform them. Through our attention and our presence, we don't have to be bound by the ghosts of the past. This is healing the present for ourself and all beings. And then Enkyo Roshi, she wrote, there is a point of disagreement with some Buddhist social activists who believe you've got to go out there and fight injustice right away. I say it's more harmful until you've really worked internally. I don't mean you have to go away for 45 years and face a wall, but from my perspective, you have to be able to know that every time you recognize an enemy out there, it is also a projection of something inside you. Even the worst you can imagine. Because until we do that, it seems fine to me, we're just recreating the same old wars, the same old stuff over and over again. It's not skillful, in my view. So this brought me to the word dignity, which it was mentioned in how one looks upon another with a great love and sees the dignity, which means the worth, which implies self-respect. What is self-worth in a system that denies the permanence of any self? What is self-worth then? There's no self. What's self-worth? And in Buddhist terms, our worth is a product of our ability to choose between right and wrong, between truth and delusion, to know the difference between wholesome and unwholesome acts. And we know that because our actions have consequences. Humans, that's us, we can deliberately choose to follow the Dharma. We can consciously awaken. This potential for enlightenment is the source of self-worth and self-respect. Bodhicitta, this aspiration to realize. So dignity is part of our karmic inheritance. And it has nothing to do with our conditions or how others view us. People have such worth even if they are completely unaware of their own capacity for awakening. It's still there. If dignity is the expression of intrinsic worth, it cannot be taken away or destroyed by the actions of others, or even by our own. So when I think of dignified behavior, as I was watching some of these old films from the Civil Rights March and those people who sat in the lunch counter in Mississippi in 1963, they sat quietly, upright, and let this happen with equanimity, a serenity in the midst of abuse. Is the picture of dignity. Did you not feel it if you watched that? Oh my God. The strength to remain still in such conditions arises from a deeply felt sense of worth that is beyond one's surroundings. And there's many stories, hundreds in our tradition, responding to abuse with grace and dignity. Now, you might not think this. It took me a while in this story, but this Japanese nun, Eshin, this was 1362. She was called the Irresistible One. Beautiful nun, right? A flying nun. And to her, the whole world was burning, kindling. Peasants rebelling against harsh conditions, tortured, executed, constant battles between samurai bands and a broken court, endless poverty, endless famine, endless greed. And she never married. She was refusing to actually consider it. And her older brother was a well-known monk who founded this temple, Saijoji. And when she was past 30, she went to Saijoji and she asked her brother to ordain her, and he refused. He said, "If I ordained you or other women, the monks would be corrupted by your presence." Eshin was a beautiful woman, and he didn't have much faith in the men he trained. So she had to not be able to study the Dharma. So she burned her face with an iron, but it still didn't take away her beauty. And after that, her brother ordained her, and she lived among many monks. And one fell in love with her and sent her notes, slipping them into her robe sleeve. I've got chocolate slipped into mine, but... And under her cushion. I used to find a chocolate bar, and I was like, I didn't have a chocolate bar. I was like, you know, these sleeves, you just, somebody walks by. We used to have a girl come to Sesshin, and that was, we could count on Hoshin, man, a chocolate bar every time. And there was this exchange. You'd kind of be at your mailbox, so your sleeves were open, and she would just drop in a chocolate bar. Because you were always so hungry for some sweet something. So he begged, you know, her, this guy that was leaving her notes, begged for her to, like, get together, you know. So she finally agreed, and she wrote to him that their meeting place would have to be secret as they were under vows of celibacy. And she passed him in the hall and whispered, "I'll set a time and place, and I'll tell you soon." So he's all, you know, jazzed up. A few days later, the community sat together in the zendo in silence, and the last to enter was her. And she stood at the doorway, completely naked, right? And everyone stared at her as she walked calmly down the hall and right before her admirer. And she said, "Well?" And she asked him loudly, "If you really love me, how about now?" Out he went. Never to return. He left. So that's kind of very dignified. It was a great graceful response to harassment. What trust and embodiment. And then there was Dao Yi Doshin, the fourth Chinese, we chanted his name, right? Dawei Doshin Dayo Sho. And he was summoned to meet the emperor who admired him. And he turned down the invitation with a polite apology, and he was summoned again, and he refused again, and he was summoned a third time. You don't refuse the third time, but he did. And that was like, eh. So the emperor said, off with his head. Kill him. So when he went to meet, well, the emperor said, either you come back with Master Daoxin, you know, that he's going to come for my request, or you bring back his head. So when the emissary met with Daoxin, he warned him of this order, and Daoxin leaned over, pulled his robes down, and offered his neck. Right for the emissary's sword, where he could reach it. Master Daoxin's dignity was an expression of this greatest of freedoms, not to be disturbed by what might happen to the body. Such composure, what is that based on? Like how deep his, I don't know, either he's wacko or he really understands emptiness and this cause, this deep faith in what he's doing, his dignity, that nobody can take away. The impermanence, but the absolute impermanence of all things. And part of the traditional definition of dignity has to do with formality, one's response to the gravity of a situation in an appropriate way. Are these appropriate ways? The dignity of a Buddha is the full awareness of each moment, accepting this time and place without resistance or clinging and responding as needed. Dignity expressed as a total presence. The emissary could not take his head off. After all, he returned to the capital and told the emperor what happened, and the emperor sent him a gift and left him alone. Interesting. In today's terms, getting to the end, the opposite of dignity is shame. In Buddhist terms, dignity and shame are aspects of one thing. And this is something the monastics were just studying. That's what, and I was very interested in this, and I'll just express my understanding of it so far, because it was this moral shame. This is goodness, actually. So these two Sanskrit words, HRI, is, I don't know how to pronounce it, HRI, is used to mean the sense of shame as well as modesty, shyness, and timidity. But in the Buddhists use HRI or HRI in Pali, which means conscious self-respect and dignity. And the key emotion when developing moral behavior and practice, it's the key emotion, the self-respect and dignity. So how can dignity be the same as shame? So it says, HRI represents the state in which we want to avoid harm and ill choices. So Bhikkhu Bodhi calls this an innate sense of shame over moral transgression. So it's a dignity of shame that over our moral transgressions. It's helpful. It's a guardian. It's a guardian. It's our conscience. It's our internal self-respect and a belief. It's expressing a belief in our worth is the source of the shame. We know we can do better. That we are better than our conditioned behavior sometimes shows. And it's coupled with this other Pali word, otapa, the awareness of consequences. What Bhikkhu Bodhi calls moral dread. We feel an internal shame when we fall short and concern with the results of falling short. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful guardian. This so-called base emotions drive us right into right view and right conduct. For many people, shame and desire to change are the stimulus for starting a practice. Great energy pours into our life, the energy to choose wholesome acts when we might otherwise slip into wrongdoing. This is a healthy shame driving us forward into virtuous acts with more care. Dignity allows us to come forward rather than trying to hide mistakes and flaws. Know me by my delusions. That's one of the best ways we can know each other. That we can hold the totality of our lives, the things imposed, and trust our Buddha nature, the nature we are each born with. How else, as a community of humans, can we find our way? We turn the story of our history into a story about you and me. That's what our group did. When our Beyond Fear of Differences group got together, we told our stories, what we learned, what our ownership of our legacy is. It was raw and vulnerable, and could feel each person so closely, like so closely. I didn't do it there, but at night it hit me. It hit me at night when I laid down. That's where it ripped me to shreds. If the body and mind can withstand the arising and ceasing of pain and suffering, there's no need to transcend anything. When we truly realize that we are not contained or limited by our idea of body, our mind, or our condition, by our ideas of life and death, then we are free to live a life of joy and delight, a life that is neither too spacey nor too constricted, a life that flies in the air like a bird, that bubbles in the ocean, that offers compassion where it is needed, without attachment to the outcome, without partiality or fixity, without phoniness, but simple, overflowing compassion and joy. May penetrating light dispel the darkness of ignorance. Dogen wrote, "How can we behave? How we can behave in any given moment? The circumstances are unimportant. We should learn," he writes, "of dignified behavior as the whole cosmos, and dignified behavior as the whole earth. The dignified posture is the body, in the great truth, being relaxed." Thank you, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.